Okay, let's unpack this. Forget the old idea that your brain is hardwired, fixed once you hit adulthood. Imagine instead something closer to clay, always capable of being reshaped. That dynamic quality, that incredible potential for change, is what neuroplasticity is all about.
Yeah, exactly.
For this deep dive, we're cracking open the sources you've shared to really explore the nature of this capability. What is it? How does it actually work down at the cellular level? And what do some wild real-world examples tell us?
Right.
We're aiming for those aha moments, exploring the brain's lifelong ability to change while also, getting real about its limits.
Precisely. We're digging into what the sources present as the fundamental reality of the brain. It's not static. It's constantly adapting. Our mission is to guide you through these findings and give you a clear picture of this process.
So let's get right into defining it. Neuroplasticity. What are we actually talking about here?
Well, the word itself gives us a big clue, doesn't it? Neuro obviously relates to the brain and its nerve cells, the neurons. And plasticity just means the quality of being easily shaped or molded.
Like that clay analogy. So it's a brain that can be molded.
At its heart, yeah. One definition from the sources, from Britannica, calls it the capacity of neurons and neural networks to change their connections and behavior. And crucially, it emphasizes that this happens in response to things, new information, sensory input, development, even damage.
Ah, so it's not just some abstract idea, but a responsive system. It reacts.
Exactly. It's about a neuron or whole circuit of neurons fundamentally altering its structure or function to perform tasks. Could be learning something new, could be finding a way around an injury.
And this change can be tiny, right? Or huge.
Yeah, microscopic, like strengthening a single connection, what we call a synapse. Or it can be a massive reorganization involving entire pathways in the brain.
And this is a relatively recent understanding, isn't it? Because for a long time, the thinking was pretty rigid.
Oh, absolutely.
That after childhood, your brain was pretty much set, like concrete.
That's a key point the sources highlight. The older belief in neuroscience was very much focused on a fixed nervous system after a certain developmental stage. But modern research paints a completely different picture. The brain is not a static, finished product. It's an ongoing process of change.
Throughout your whole life.
Throughout your entire life, yeah. It changes to enable learning, memory, and fascinatingly, in some cases, even rewires itself to compensate for damage.
Which sounds like mostly good news, but the sources also mention a flip side, a but.
They frame it clearly as having both good news and bad news. And that's really important context to keep in mind. The good news is that this plasticity is an ongoing process, a lifelong capacity. It helps us learn, adapt,
And recover from some things.
and can even contribute to recovery from certain types of damage, yes.
Okay, the bad news then.
The bad news is that it's not unlimited. Its capacity isn't uniform across all brain regions or all functions. And importantly, its capability generally diminishes as we age. It's still there, but maybe not as vigorous as in early childhood.
Right. So understanding this helps set realistic expectations.
Exactly.
All right. So we have this definition of a dynamic, responsive brain, but how? How does it actually pull this off? What are the nuts and bolts, the specific mechanisms the sources describe?
Well, neuroplasticity happens at both structural and functional levels. Think of structural changes as physical alterations, like adding or removing connections or changing their size, their physical shape. Functional changes are about how those connections behave. Are they more or less responsive? Do they fire more easily?
And they're linked, presumably.
Oh, definitely. Often these are intertwined. Physical changes affect function, and changes in function can lead to physical changes over time. The line can be blurry.
Okay, so what's one of the fundamental ways these changes happen? How does the brain learn?
A core mechanism, particularly important for learning and memory, is called long-term potentiation, LTP for short.
LTP.
Imagine a specific pathway in the brain. If you stimulate it repeatedly and quickly, the connection between the neurons in that pathway gets stronger. The postsynaptic neuron, the receiving one, becomes much more responsive to the input from the presynaptic neuron, the sender.
So kind of like if you keep practicing a skill, the brain pathway involved gets more efficient, more reactive, a well-trodden path.
That's the idea, yeah. The sources mention experiments, for instance, in the hippocampus, a key memory area. They found that repeated stimulation dramatically increases the strength of the synaptic response in one pathway compared to another one that wasn't stimulated.
Wow.
This process is considered a fundamental building block for how memories are initially formed and how connections are strengthened through experience.
And it happens in specific places.
Yeah, it's observed in key areas involved in learning, like parts of the hippocampus, but also sensory systems, the cortex.
Yeah.
It's pretty widespread where learning happens.
And if there's potentiation, making things stronger, is there an opposite, making them weaker?
Precisely. There's long-term depression, or LTD.
Okay, LTD.
This happens when stimulation is less frequent, often slower. Instead of getting stronger, the synaptic response actually gets weaker over time.
So weakening connections, is that like how we might, I don't know, unlearn something, or maybe how less important information fades away?
That's a good way to think about it. While LTP strengthens connections, LTD prunes them back, or weakens them. Which is also essential, right, for the brain to adapt and not become overloaded with equally strong, trivial connections. You need to forget stuff, too.
Makes sense. So these are specific mechanisms. Is there a broader term?
Well, synaptic strengthening is just a general term. It covers any process that increases synaptic strength, the ratio of output to input, basically.
Mm.
LTP is a prime example of synaptic strengthening.
Got it. Okay, strengthening and weakening connections make sense for learning. What about getting rid of connections entirely? The sources mention something called synaptic pruning.
Yes. This is where the gardening analogy really fits. Synaptic pruning is the brain's way of trimming away unused or less efficient synapses. It's a critical process, particularly during development.
And it happens on a fairly dramatic timeline, you know?
Oh, yeah. Very dramatic. From the early embryonic stages right up to about age 2, there's an explosion of synapse formation. Your brain is just building connections like crazy.
Overbuilding, almost.
You can say that. Then, from around age 2 to 10, there is a period of rapid, intense pruning, literally removing many of those initial connections.
Wow, removing them.
Yeah. This continues through adolescence, mm-hmm. mainly shaping the prefrontal cortex, the bit involved in planning and decision-making. And it kind of tapers off in the late 20s. It's like sculpting the brain by removing the excess material.
And the sources note that disruptions in this pruning process, like problems with the sculpting, might be linked to certain conditions.
They point to some really fascinating associations, though it's important, as they stress, that these are complex links, not simple cause and effect.
Right, correlations, not necessarily causation.
Exactly. Some theories suggest that conditions like schizophrenia might involve overpruning, maybe too much trimming. Potentially linked to genetic factors, especially during that critical pruning period in adolescence. This could lead to fewer overall connections in certain cortical areas.
Your connection.
Though intriguingly, some research mentioned in the sources also found more dendritic spikes, part of the connection in a specific part of the hippocampus in some cases. So it's complex.
So maybe it's not just a simple too much or too little pruning overall, but specific patterns or maybe timing.
It really appears to be that complex, yes. On the other side, conditions like autism and savant ability syndrome are sometimes associated with underpruning.
Less trimming.
Yeah. The idea is that fewer connections are removed, mm-hmm. potentially leading to higher local connectivity, maybe more intense focus or specialized skills in some cases. But again, the sources note this is complex. It might depend on which brain areas are affected and at what age.
And savant syndrome connection.
They point out that savant syndrome is much more common within the autistic population, which might be tied to this potential difference in pruning. It just underscores how critical the balance and timing of pruning are for typical brain function.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about when neurons aren't just unused but actually lost, like through injury or disease?
That can trigger something called denervation supersensitivity. If a neuron loses some of its usual inputs because connected neurons are damaged or lost,
yeah.
the postsynaptic neuron, the receiving one, can become extra sensitive to the input signals it does still receive.
How does it do that? Does it just like turn up the volume?
Kind of. It compensates by developing more receptors on its surface for the neurotransmitters it receives, little landing pads for the chemical signals.
Oh.
That essentially makes it more likely to fire even with less input signal, trying to make up for the lost connections.
Are there examples?
The sources give the example of skeletal muscle cells, showing this when they lose their nerve connection. They become more sensitive.
But it has limits.
Oh, yeah. They also note there are limits. This compensation can only do so much if the damage is too extensive.
And then there's the remarkable idea that the brain can actually grow new neurons in adulthood that used to be considered impossible, right?
Yes, adult neurogenesis. For a long, long time, The dogma was that mammals, including us, stopped generating new functional neurons after early development. That was it. But research has shown this isn't true. New neurons are generated throughout life.
Really? Where? Everywhere?
No, not everywhere. The sources are clear this happens in quite restricted areas, primarily in the hippocampus, which, as we mentioned, is vital for learning and memory.
So new cells specifically in the learning and memory department. That makes sense.
It does seem targeted, yeah.
So summarizing the how then. The brain can strengthen or weaken connections, LTP, LTD, remove unused ones, pruning, become more sensitive if inputs are lost, denervation supersensitivity, and even add brand new neurons in specific places, adult neurogenesis. How do these mechanisms contribute to the brain's ability to recover or compensate when it's damaged? That seems like the next big piece.
This is where we see the real power of plasticity in action, especially in recovery. The sources discussed some ways the brain tries to compensate. One early concept was equipotentiality.
Equipotentiality, okay.
The idea here was that if a part of a functional system was damaged, an intact part could just take over its job, like any part could do anything.
Did that hold up?
Well, early memory research seemed to support it, kind of. Researchers found that small lesions didn't wipe out memory completely unless the damaged area was really large. This led to the hypothesis that maybe functions weren't strictly localized but distributed, or that remaining parts were just equivalent and could compensate.
But didn't other research, like famous case studies, show that damaging specific areas did cause very specific losses?
Exactly. Cases like HM, where damage to a specific part of the hippocampus caused profound memory loss, strongly supported the idea of localized function. You damage the memory center, you lose memory.
So equipotentiality, maybe not fully accepted now.
Well, the sources present a slightly different take, too, suggesting that within a specific functional area, like a cortical association area, maybe the different parts are somewhat equivalent. So remaining sections could compensate for incomplete damage within that specific area. It's nuanced.
Okay, so maybe not any part can do anything, but within a team, others can step up if one member is down.
That's a decent analogy. There's still ongoing understanding here.
What's a clearer way the brain compensates for damage then? A less controversial one.
That brings us to vicariation. This term specifically refers to one brain area or system essentially stepping in or compensating for the loss or damage of another.
Okay, vicarious function, like one area working on behalf of another.
Exactly. And the sources provide great examples here.
Like what?
Think about stroke recovery. If a stroke damages areas controlling movement on one side of the body.
Yeah.
Undamaged areas, often on the other side of the brain controlling the other side of the body, might actually increase their connections and activity.
To help the damaged side.
To try and help regain some control over the affected side, yes. Or after a traumatic brain injury impacting memory, new connections can form between different areas involved in learning to try and compensate for the damaged regions.
And it's not just motor or memory, but sensory loss too, right? You mentioned that earlier.
Absolutely. If someone experiences significant hearing loss, the brain might actually repurpose parts of the auditory cortex or increase connections in visual processing areas.
I visual.
Well, this can enhance their ability to process visual cues, like sign language or lip reading, making those skills sharper.
Wow.
Similarly, with vision loss, the brain often boosts connections in auditory and tactile areas, hearing and touch, making those senses sharper to help navigate and interact with the world.
It's like the brain redistributes its resources.
It's a remarkable demonstration of the brain finding a way to adapt its existing resources, repurposing them.
Is there also a kind of temporary disruption that shows how connected everything is, like a ripple effect from damage?
Yes, that's described as diaschesis. This isn't compensation in the same way, but a temporary decrease in function in a brain region that is connected to an area that was damaged.
Even if that connected region wasn't directly harmed itself.
Exactly. So damaging point A temporarily affects point B, even if B is structurally fine.
Why does that happen?
The precise reasons aren't fully understood, but it's thought to involve temporary changes in synaptic activity or neurotransmitter levels. Basically, the disruption in the connected area throws things off balance temporarily.
And the key is temporary.
Yes, the key characteristic is that it's usually temporary, and function tends to recover over time as the system restabilizes.
Can you give examples of that temporary state?
Sure. Think about the immediate aftermath of a stroke. You might see temporary weakness or language issues in areas not directly hit by the stroke, but connected to the stroke site. Or temporary cognitive changes, maybe headaches or dizziness after a concussion, or even after brain surgery near a removed tumor. These can often be instances of dyschisis, of functional depression in connected areas that typically resolves.
Okay, that makes sense. So we've looked at the definition, the tiny cellular mechanisms like LTP and pruning, and how those scale up to compensate for damage through things like vicariation. Pulling this all together, what do these sources tell us about the fundamental nature of neuroplasticity? What are its core features?
They emphasize a few core characteristics that really define this capability. First, that plasticity varies with age.
Right, we touched on that. More active when you're young.
Definitely. It's most robust, most active in the very early years of life, particularly the first few after birth. That's when the brain is rapidly developing and forming its initial blueprint.
But it doesn't disappear, does it? It's not like it switches off at age 25.
Absolutely not. That's the second key point. Plasticity continues throughout lifetime. While the degree might change, maybe it's less dramatic, the brain's capacity for change doesn't stop. Neurons and networks involved in learning, memory, and adapting to experience remain capable of plasticity even in adulthood and old age.
And compensation for damage can still happen later in life, too.
Yes, as we saw with stroke recovery examples, reorganization can happen at older ages, too.
And the third characteristic circles back to that bad news or the limits we mentioned early on.
Yes, it's the critical reminder that neuroplasticity is not the cure for all. It has significant limitations.
It's not magic.
It's not magic, no. Some brain regions appear to have very little capacity for generating new neurons or major reorganization. And widespread or severe damage might not be fully recoverable, even with some compensatory efforts. It's a powerful force, but it operates within biological constraints.
Okay. Now, here's where it gets really interesting, I think. Let's look at some specific examples from the sources that vividly illustrate these points about the nature and mechanisms of neuroplasticity in action.
Yeah, the real world stuff. One classic example showing structural change in adulthood is the study of London taxi drivers.
Ah, the knowledge.
Exactly. To get licensed, they have to pass this incredibly intense spatial memory test, memorizing thousands of streets and roads. Studies found that experienced London cabbies have a significantly larger posterior hippocampus, that's the back part of the hippocampus, strongly associated with spatial navigation compared to control groups.
A physically bigger brain region because of their job.
Physically bigger, yes. And that size difference correlated with their experiences. The increase in size in that region correlated with how long they've been driving taxis.
Wow. Did anything get smaller?
Interestingly, yeah. Their anterior hippocampus, the front part, was slightly smaller, suggesting maybe a potential trade-off or a redistribution of resources within that brain region based on this intensive specific learning.
It's concrete evidence of the adult brain physically restructuring itself based on demands.
Absolutely. Clear as day.
Learning a new language shows changes too, right? Not just spatially.
It does. Acquiring a second language can lead to structural changes, specifically increasing gray matter density. More cell bodies and connections in a part of the left side of the brain involved in language processing and reading, the left inferior parietal cortex.
And does it matter how good you are or when you learned it?
Both seem to matter. The extent of this change correlates with proficiency, how well you speak the language. And interestingly, the age at which you learn the language. Earlier acquisition is linked to higher gray matter density in this area, again, showing those age differences in plasticity playing out.
Fascinating. And the brain's ability to repurpose areas when sensory input is lost, like with blindness.
That's a powerful demonstration of functional plasticity, yeah. Mm. In individuals with visual impairment, the visual cortex, which isn't getting visual signals anymore.
Yeah, what happens to it?
It becomes active in processing other senses, like touch, hearing, and smell. It gets recruited, essentially drafted into service to help process non-visual information.
So that brain real estate doesn't just sit empty and unused.
No, it's repurposed. And the sources highlight that when the impairment occurred matters significantly. Someone blind from birth, congenital impairment, might show a thicker visual cortex and potentially stronger cross-plasticity.
Meaning
their visual cortex is more readily recruited by other senses compared to someone who loses sight later in life.
So early development sets the stage for later adaptation.
It suggests that early developmental plasticity really influences later adaptive capacity, yes.
What about learning a new skill that uses a different sense? The example of sighted adults learning Braille, that seems related.
Very related. That study showed that even in sighted adults, learning Braille over several months changed how the brain processed tactile information, touch. Their reading network in the brain, usually activated by vision, began to respond to touch input from reading Braille dots.
Functionally change, any structural changes.
Yes. They also observed structural changes like an increase in gray matter volume and changes in the insulation around nerve fibers, the myelin and sensory areas. It shows how learning complex skills involving new sensory inputs can drive both dynamic functional shifts and potentially longer-term structural alterations. You can see both happening.
Beyond skill learning, the sources also provide some truly remarkable cases of the brain compensating after significant challenges. Real human stories.
They do. The case of Cheryl Schultz is extraordinary. She lost her balance function completely due to antibiotic damage. Vestibular system wiped out.
Terrible. How did she cope?
Her doctor devised this amazing system. A helmet with sensors detected her head movements and sent signals to a little device she held on her tongue.
On her tongue?
Yeah, electrical signals on her tongue representing balance information. And her brain, through plasticity, learned to interpret these entirely novel artificial signals as balance information.
And she could balance again.
It allowed her to regain her equilibrium. It just shows the brain's incredible capacity to adapt and learn to use completely new sensory inputs, even artificial ones.
That's incredible adaptation using technology. What about compensation for major physical brain damage, like losing part of your brain?
The case of a six-year-old boy is often cited in this context. He had to have a large part of his right hemisphere removed, including areas usually crucial for vision because of a severe tumor causing seizures.
A hemispherectomy? That sounds drastic.
Extremely drastic. But his left hemisphere, remarkably, took over functions that are typically handled by the right, like face and object recognition.
And his overall abilities.
His cognitive abilities remained strong, and his IQ even slightly improved post-surgery, possibly because the seizures stopped. It highlights the extraordinary compensatory power and resilience of the young brain.
That age factor again.
Absolutely. A similar powerful example is Maura Lieb.
What happened with her?
Maura was born with severe damage to her left hemisphere from a prenatal stroke. Left side, largely non-functional. She underwent a hemispherectomy at just 9 months old, removing the damaged left hemisphere.
And her right brain took over.
Her right hemisphere, with intensive therapy and rehabilitation, developed the ability to handle functions typically located in the left hemisphere, including complex speech and motor skills, things normally impossible for the right side alone.
Wow.
These cases just underscore the profound capacity for reorganization, particularly in the early, highly plastic brain. They illustrate that age difference in plasticity really powerfully.
Those examples are truly inspiring, showing what's possible. But we also mentioned that not all regions are equally plastic. What do the sources say about that? Where is it stronger or weaker?
They suggest that while the capacity for plasticity exists throughout the brain, it does seem to vary. And it depends a bit on how you define it. Are you talking about routine change from learning or adaptation after damage?
Okay. Which areas are considered more plastic in response to normal experiences and learning day to day?
Regions like the hippocampus, no surprise there, given memory. Also, the visual cortex, the motor cortex, and the prefrontal cortex.
Why those?
It makes sense, given their roles, right?
Yeah.
Memory, sensory input, movement control, and higher level thought, like planning and decision making. These all require constant updating and adaptation based on your experience.
And for recovering from damage, which areas have a better shot?
The hippocampus, again, is noted, partly because of that adult neurogenesis potential we talked about. It can actually make some new cells. The motor cortex also has significant reorganization capacity after damage, like we saw in stroke recovery.
And which are maybe less likely to fully recover.
Areas like the visual cortex and prefrontal cortex, while they show some recovery potential through rehabilitation, might have a lower probability of full recovery after major damage compared to, say, the motor cortex. Though some recovery is often passable.
Are there areas considered generally less plastic overall?
The sources mention the basal ganglia. These are deep brain structures involved in motor control and habits. They potentially have less neurogenesis capacity. And the primary auditory cortex is also suggested as being perhaps less plastic than other sensory areas like the visual cortex, which seems quite adaptable.
So wrapping all this up then, what's the big takeaway about the nature of neuroplasticity from these sources? What should we leave people thinking about?
I think the core insight is that the brain isn't a static machine. It's fundamentally a dynamic system built for change. Neuroplasticity is the underlying biological capacity for that change, and it's driven by everything you experience, everything you learn, and even challenges like injury or developmental differences.
And this happens through those specific mechanisms we discussed, strengthening and weakening connections, LTP, LTD, pruning away old ones, maybe adding new ones in some places.
Right. And through larger scale compensation and reorganization when parts are damaged, like vicariation.
While the degree of this capacity shifts with age, being most pronounced early on, it fundamentally continues throughout your entire life.
Exactly. It's powerful, enabling learning and recovery, but it does have limits, and those limits vary across different brain regions. It's not infinite.
So knowing that your brain right now possesses this capacity to adapt, learn, and even reorganize itself perhaps more than you previously thought, how does that change the way you think about acquiring new skills, facing cognitive challenges, or simply engaging with the world around you? This understanding truly opens up possibilities for what's achievable for the human brain at any stage of life.